Hello, iGaming Intelligentsia. Before we start today's podcast, here is a message from our sponsors. The iGaming Next podcast is made possible with the support from our sponsors at Pragmatic Solutions, leaders in intelligent platform technology. I've been working with Ashley, Lewis, and the guys over at Pragmatic Solutions over the last year. And as the early supporter of this podcast, I cannot recommend them enough. The Pragmatic Solutions Player Account Management Platform is an incredibly powerful technology stack for today's gaming business. Their modern modular platform provides all the core services to power your business, and their SaaS licensing model allows you to reduce cost and accelerate your strategic goals. Enterprise technology with decades of operational know-how at scale built in. Upgrade your business to the Pragmatic Solutions PAM platform. Visit www.pragmatic.solutions to arrange a platform demo. This podcast is brought to you by Kalamba Games, where they build the world's most engaging slots. To find out more about their hit titles, promotional tools, and Bullseye Remote Gaming Server, visit kalambagames.com. I have the privilege of being friends with several of the guys over at Kalamba, and they are fantastic. And I'm not saying that to be invited to one of their legendary office pool parties. Or maybe I am. In any case, check out kalambagames.com. Rebel Status are an award-winning boutique headhunting firm within the iGaming space. They have been delivering recruitment and senior search assignments for more than 20 years, with industry-leading guarantees and assessments. They are more than just headhunters, with an emphasis on long-term relationships and a foundation that has been built on quality, transparency, and relentless obsession with providing excellence. We, as iGaming Next, have been using Rebel Status for our own recruitment, and they have always been great to us, so make sure to check them out.
Future trends, deep insights, industry leaders. This is the iGaming Next podcast with your host, Pierre Lind.
Knock, knock.
Who's there?
Hank.
Hank who?
Thank you for being back in the podcast, James.
This is the effect lockdown's had on you, isn't it?
Yes, yeah, we're locked down here in Malta. I apologize. I don't know how I'm going to recover from this today, but yeah, there we go.
At least I guess anything I say will not be as bad in comparison. So
Exactly. I show myself out. But yeah, James, it's nice to have you here again, I must say. One of the reasons and one of the things that I really love about this podcast is the fact that, you know, through the year that I've done this podcast, I've got to know so many cool people. And obviously, through the first episode that we did back in September last year, it was the first time we encountered each other. And, you know, since then, we kind of struck up a really nice little friendship here that kind of came out of this podcast. So, you know, that's one of the reasons I do this podcast. So yeah, without hyping you up too much here, James, I just wanted to start this podcast by saying thank you.
And thank you for having me.
Awesome. So James, you're the director of sales of GIG, obviously passionate about the industry. You've been in the industry for a long time. But I want to start on a little bit different side today. You know, we have a shared interest, which is the fact that we are both runners. And I'm not going to put myself in the same category as you by any means whatsoever. Although I do run some races, I've run two marathons and so on and so forth. But that is obviously eclipsed by the fact that you have run through the desert, which is a testament to the shirt you're wearing behind you. So I wanted to start today. Something that interests me quite a lot in general is the fact that, you know, doing these kind of challenges and going through this like gritty situations in general, kind of for me, it's something that is something that I try to do as much as I can. Like it kind of builds character a little bit, and I feel that. Is something that helps me in my professional life. But can you just talk a little bit about the race that you did and this passion of yours in general and how that ties together with your career?
Yeah, I mean, touching on the race was a few years ago now. I think back in 17. Like, as you touched on, I guess I sort of always enjoyed running, keeping fit. Like, you know, the benefit with running is always, it has always been like twofold for me. Obviously, one, the fitness side, it's a good thing to keep healthy. But a huge part of it is like the mental side as well. You know, you can have that really stressful day in the office and you can just go for a run, sort of be free in your own thoughts and sort of decompartmentalize everything and come up with a lot of solutions on it and finish sort of feeling a lot calmer, as well as quite good about yourself, obviously having been out for one. But yeah, from sort of doing it, I guess, more as a casual, kind of casual bit of recreational sport, I watched a program on a guy that Brit, an ex-rower, in fact, that had run like what they called the hardest race in the world. And his challenge was like to try and be the fastest Brit to have ever done it. As you say, it's the one that sort of highlighted the shirt behind me, the Marathon de Sable. In short, it's 160 miles over the Sahara Desert, where you basically have to carry your own supplies. So your own food, your kit. And then you get rationed water every sort of 10, 15 miles by the organizers. But other than that, you're basically in the desert for 10 days, kind of up and down mountains, over the sand and in the heat. And for me, it was like setting a goal that put purpose kind of beyond the sort of, as sort of mentioned, like, you know, the physical benefit of going for a run and the mental benefit. I just tried like massive kind of purpose to all of that and see how far I could push my body. And sort of set some kind of quite big goals around it. Firstly, on the fundraising for MenCap, which is, you know, a mental health charity here in the UK. So to sort of set a goal to raise a sort of not insubstantial amount for them, but also set kind of a goal for myself to finish within a certain kind of grouping. I don't think ever planned to be the fastest Brit, but at least to be in a decent position. And then thought, like, why not just sort of put my all into it for 60 months, you know, train daily and get as much support as possible to see how far I could push my body. And that's sort of the short of the shirt behind me. The other part of the shirt behind me worth pointing out, because it was such a big support, was the industry, and specifically Andy Jones at Ali Quantum, who I think a few days into me saying, you know, I'm doing this race and I'm going to be raising money, called me up and was like, right, how can I support you? And so from there, he became a main sponsor and was a huge support through the whole training piece, then obviously the run itself. But, you know, beyond Andy, the industry was amazing. Said everyone was throwing support towards me, both sort of vocally as well as kind of financially to the charity. Which was pretty cool.
Yeah, it's cool with Andy Jones of Ali Quantum. That's the guy, right?
Yes, that's right.
A bit of a legend in the industry. Andy has seen a lot in the at the events, and you know, that's one of the things that I really appreciate about the AGM industry in general, is that you know, It's a big industry in some sense. You know, there's a lot of people who work in this industry, but the community that actually meets and talks across industries is much smaller. But it is a very tight community. So when you're in those circles, it's circles that really help each other out, even across competitors and so on and so forth. Like, the transparency within that circle, I think, is something that makes the AGM industry a lot better. And you know, we talked as well about, you know, the fact that that player protection and these type of topics are really on the radar at the moment for a lot of organizations. And you ask yourself the question, you know, why is that? You know, compared to 10 years ago, when it wasn't really a topic that many iGaming operators and suppliers wanted to touch on, you know, but it's something that GIG have done really well. Like, so why is it that you guys are focusing so much on these type of questions?
I mean, for one, player protection is sort of, I think, the future and elongivity of this industry, and ensuring that's kind of improved and handled correctly will make sure that we, as a kind of gambling industry, have a long life. Like, it should be really the sort of first point that everyone goes to when setting up an operation. You know, the last thing an industry needs is to be massively tainted with kind of bad news surrounding players, because the protection just wasn't there for them. Whether it's sort of enticing addicts to spend more and obviously go into some quite dark places, or attracting people of, you know, the wrong age, for example. Like, that is where in the early days there was probably a lot of negative connotation built up around the industry. And I think sort of like we, at least with our technologies, doing as much as we can to combat and give the tools to the partners that we have to sort of best tackle that as well. And I think kind of there's a lot to be said and to be done by companies like us, by the sort of technology, the providers, in enabling through the sort of product that we deliver, better protection around the players that operators then handle. Mm-hmm. You know, you see in other industries, right? Like, you know, the car industry, for example, they set, you know, the option to have speed limiters. There's automatic braking on cars now. There's like automated, you know, lane functionality. Ultimately, it's still down to the driver. Like, they are the one that can still sort of override that, and something negative could happen, sure. But what the manufacturers are doing is putting everything in place that they possibly can do to empower and give that kind of safety piece. And we do it and do more and more of, and continue to sort of put our efforts into developing, you know, get as much automation around player safety as we can. You know, notice, give tools that pick up patterns that could lead to someone being a problem gambler, for example, that, you know, we can then put blockers into, as opposed to just focusing on sort of pure marginal profit drivers.
Yeah,
because ultimately, if you're not protecting the players, you know, you're coming in for a very short term win to then sort of be dissipated by either strict regulation because you've not done it properly. All those players, you know, end up not playing anymore due to running out of money or worse.
Yeah. And, you know, I think as well, if I were to analyze the situation as well with player protection and the reason why it's so hot now and not 10 years ago, and, you know, it would, at first glance, it would seem counterintuitive from a business, or from a pure business perspective, that you want the players to gamble less. And I think or certain players to gamble less. And I think that...
You want them to gamble within their means. Like,
yeah.
Again, to sort of keep the industry going and even grow it, you need them to gamble within their means, right? Like,
yeah.
If you're having an enjoyable and entertaining time gambling within your means, you're likely to pass on that story or talk about it to others.
Yeah.
However, if you're in the sort of problem gambler category, spending all your money, going in some really dark places with your gambling, you're not going to sit around and sort of promote the industry. And what happens is it then gets to a really, really negative point. And that or those players end up in quite a dark place that, you know, either sees legal action, sees people going to court, sees the newspapers, and it's that extreme part of it that we need to cut out, because that's what's going to, that will keep getting picked up if we don't do something about it or do more about it.
Exactly. And I think, like, to add to that as well, I think those reasons are really valid. But, you know, looking back 10 years ago and still comparing it to now, you know, those facts were true 10 years ago as they are now as well. But I think adding to this as well is the fact that the gaming industry is in its infancy, right? And, you know, you learn through trial and error, the industry grows year on year. And, you know, 10 years ago, the industry was much more rudimentary than it is now, let's say. The massive organizations were still not that big, and they were quite new organizations, and even on the supplier side, like organizations like GIG didn't exist at that time. You know, operators were building their own very rudimentary platforms and so on and so forth. And but I think, like, look now at 2021 with multi-billion euro companies on the radar, and companies like GIG. I mean, your business model is essentially to bring organizations into our ecosystem, that is into the iGaming ecosystem. That is kind of your business model, right?
Yeah. And I mean, we're largely sort of looking or kind of partnering with, as you say, you know, these like based or retail businesses or media businesses within either regulated or sort of soon to be regulated markets. And yeah, just kind of safely bring them into the iGaming space.
Yeah, so now there is an incentive all of a sudden for you guys as GIG, you know, to get out there to the to outside of the iGaming industry and bring in you know more liquidity into the industry, and by doing so, you have to be seen and you have to be a reputable company to be able to pull in these type of deals from reputable organizations who are traditionally maybe looked down on the iGaming industry a bit. Like, it's in GIG's interest to actually transcend that and to be a force for good in the industry.
Yeah, and it works both ways, right? Like,
yeah,
it's one that people are looking at us and looking at the sort of levels of transparency that I think you know we put forward. But it's also, and I think, again, as the wider industry, we all have a part to play in this, is knowing who we're partnering with. You know, like we've had sort of cases of what on the outset could look like a great opportunity for us. You know, someone in a certain market that's got good exposure through it. You know, we've had a few early conversations and they've sort of liked what they've seen of our product. And then we kind of go into due diligence phase, or an early sort of high level due diligence phase, and it comes out that, well, part of the ownership or whoever it might be has, you know, had cases of fraud or, you know, money laundering or something like this, worse in some cases. And then it becomes on us actually to say, right, we're going to stop the process now. We're not going to move forward with you because we can't keep bringing in potential sort of harm, risk, you know, tainted characters or businesses into the industry when we're trying to an extent, clean it up a little bit. Hmm. We being exactly. The sort of wider industry, not sort of, you know, it's a sole mission by us. But
yeah, exactly. And you know, turning the question around a little bit, here, James, like when you guys speak to, you know, obviously you guys are trying to cast your net a little bit here and there to attract clients. And I would imagine that, you know, there are a few dream clients that you would like to bring on board to GIG. And do you face sometimes these type of issues that we are talking about now, where you approach organizations that you want to bring into your ecosystem that perhaps don't want to come on board because of the stigmatization of the iGaming industry?
No, I mean, I think if that was ever the case, they probably wouldn't take the early conversations, to be honest. Yeah. Like, you know, it's reasonably clear who we are when we approach a sort of potential partner or kind of go fishing, as you allude to with the nets. I think there is more a case in some scenarios where, let's say, a business will have heavy kind of involvement locally, and therefore they're sort of on the edge, I suppose, about whether they may or may want to look into gambling. Perhaps their market is on the cusp of regulating, so it's kind of in a peripheral view that they may or may not sort of look at something like that. And it can sometimes be on us to reassure them that it isn't this kind of big bad thing that's going to destroy, you know, their reach, in a sense, of turn them all kind of into dark addict gamblers. So yeah, we do it at that point, sort of push on, you know, the positives and the entertainment side of it, which ultimately is like, you know, we're not pushing to, as said, like create a bunch of people absolutely addicted without any enjoyment to this industry. We want this to be what it should be, which is a form of entertainment.
Exactly. And I guess that leads in a little bit as well. You know, I like to talk about vision and, you know, the big questions and, you know, what is the purpose of all of this as an industry and all the things, you know, but if I look at GIG, you know, and I'm a very like, as an MD of my company, I'm very future driven. So I like to think about like, where can we go in the future, or what is our vision as an organization? And if I look at GIG from that lens, you know, I would think that the dream scenario for GIG would be to bring a company like, let's say, like CNN or something to bring a board on your platform. Now we are talking about, now we're way beyond what is possible today. But I think, you know, what are the blockers here, you know, to bring a company like CNN on board to the GIG's platform and open an operator? Would you say as well that kind of the GIG's kind of vision or long-term vision, is it to kind of cast a net that wide, or like how do you view the deals that you will set in the future?
I mean, I think they're reflecting of the deals, like the deals we're setting now and the partnerships that we are starting on at the minute are looked at as long-term partnerships. Yeah. You know, are, again, sort of alluding to the you know, client type that we're sort of going for and partnering with, it is with long-term vision. They are partners that would be around not just for a kind of 2-3 year game, but that we envisage being sort of serious markets for 5-10 years and beyond. Which is why, you know, as you alluded to earlier on in the conversations, that we do look at, for example, media businesses that are looking to diversify their portfolio where there's opportunity, like, you know, with things like market regulation, and retail and land base that have sort of been in the gambling space through the offline operation that again are looking to diversify what they offer through digital. But these are all client types that will be there for the long term, that we can go on journeys with, that we can, you know, reflect our product roadmaps to sort of what their kind of journey is asking for.
Yeah, absolutely. So I mean, when I bring up the
big blockers for your huge networks, and I think, you know, it's only a matter of time before they do, if they're not already, kind of start looking like there are larger networks globally that are looking into the space or have started buying technologies or operations in gambling.
Yeah.
I think there was one, who was it, like MultiChoice recently bought an operation down in through Africa. Like they're one of the biggest media networks across Africa with lots of sports rights. They bought a gambling operation to sort of push out that arm. You know, Fubo TV, who are the sort of, I think, kind of up and coming streaming service in the US, they've sort of publicly announced that they're either purchasing or making movement in the gambling space as well, or sports betting space. So it's happening already. And I think, again, like what we're doing at GIG is best positioning ourselves to be able to cater for that type of business that I think kind of at the front and sort of foremost of their requirements is the player safety piece ultimately.
Yeah. So, you know, it's an interesting topic because it's partly a player protection and genuinely be able to kind of have a long-term goal to, I don't know if it's possible to eliminate harmful gambling, like what Kindred have set out to do, for example, which is eliminating harmful gambling by 2023. It's a very, very ambitious goal. But even if it's not possible, the goal is still to obviously minimize harmful gambling as much as you possibly can, to the point where the industry is not seen as a something negative for society, I guess.
Exactly. I think that was a great initiative from Kindred, you know, and to be so transparent about that. Again, like, sort of keep banging on about it, but transparency for me is key to you know, really bringing us into a sort of better light beyond you know, the community that we are. And I think people like Kindred are making steps. Like, I think it's great every year to see Denise Coates pay so much tax. You know, because again, it is actually a reflection that we can be here to do good. Obviously, paying tax, that's going into government coffers and hopefully sort of again used for good. And I think setting out these big goals like Kindred have done is exactly what we need to do more.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I look at that use case as an example. I mean, Kindred, what they are doing through this commitment is they are pushing the needle to legitimize the entire industry. You know, it's a very, very ambitious goal they are setting to themselves. Like, what do you think about that deal? What do you make of Kindred's commitment in general? Do you, like, what's your analysis? Do you think it's reasonable? Do you think they were able to do it? And what's your analysis?
And again, now they've made it sort of public, they're accountable to achieve that, right?
Yes.
And I think down to that, they're going to get as absolutely close as possible. I think, as you see with anything in life, it's probably impossible to achieve a kind of 100% no risk, no harm. You know, as I said, like using cars as an example, you can put as much safety kind of protocol in as you want, but ultimately, you'll never, I think, eliminate a crash. You know, same with the alcohol industry. Again, you can put as much in as absolutely possible to protect drinkers. You'll never 100% eliminate sort of the extreme alcoholic or drunk. But I think, you know, as a business within that space, you can sort of really push to get as close to as close to that goal as you possibly can. And I think they will. But I think, again, this is why it's great that they've come out and said it, because they're now sort of, they're definitely accountable for trying to achieve that. And if more people came out and set these type of kind of goals, they suddenly become accountable for achieving that. It's not just something kind of said in an internal meeting or, you know, in a values debate at the company.
Yeah. Why do you think they set the goal now and not 10 years ago? Is it down to technology or is there also other factors?
Yeah, I think technology plays a big piece. It's like you touching earlier on sort of how things have changed in terms of, I guess, the onus on areas like player protection. I think it was probably harder in the earlier stages of online, you know, online gambling, but also when it started, it was the early stages in general of online, right? Kind of what policing the online piece in general from kind of day one, the early 2000s, even around, you know, 2010 was harder than it is now. And I think technology has come so much further and we know it can do so much to really support, you know, bold statements like Kindred's. Whereas I think it would have been that much harder 10 years ago to have said, you know, we're going to go out and completely eliminate X, Y, and Z, but there perhaps weren't the tools to be able to do it then.
Yeah.
As again, with any industry, you know, things progress and the reason things didn't happen in the first instance is because that piece wasn't there to stop it. Like, you know, again, cars, putting limiters on speeds, you know, or lane automation, things, they just weren't there 10 years ago. So that option, you couldn't really say, you know, why didn't they do it then? It was because they couldn't.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I guess this, I would say as well that it seems, even from Kindred's statement as well, that they are also saying that we cannot do this on our own. The technology has to follow this development. Like, we have to have the tool in place to be able to actually detect harmful gambling, like, you know, before it happens or very close to it, at least, to be able to speak to the players and so forth. So it will be very interesting. So they, Kindred, have committed to basically disclose the revenue from harmful gambling in each quarterly report. So starting now from the Q4 report in 2020. So it'll be interesting to see.
Imagine if everyone did that.
What was that? Sorry.
Imagine if everyone did that.
Yeah, Yeah, you know, imagine. Like, yes, they are leading the way now. I mean,
that would start making, and I think that's where it's going to go. This is where, you know, perhaps people fool themselves sometimes in thinking, you know, we can just get away with it, so it'll never happen. It will. Like, you know, they are anticipating perhaps future strict regulation where that will become part of what a company has to do. Like, you know, the UK's a market that's maturer than a lot of others in terms of its regulation and sort of time it's been regulated. And, you know, perhaps other less mature, like more recently regulated markets are still slightly more flexible. But I think it's a matter of time before others just start following a similar kind of line and stance. Some we see go to an extreme, and, you know, sometimes that's not right. Like Italy having, you know, ban on advertising. I actually think that's wrong, because there should be parameters set around advertising, how advertising is delivered and when it's delivered, but not an outright ban, because there is a benefit to advertising that can actually help direct people that want to gamble, to place bets, to the right sites. You know, if you're allowing people that abide by your regulation, then you should want to sort of put those as the ones forward to the people that regardless will want to gamble. You want to put those brands up because you know you're regulating them, and they're a safe place to kind of go and play. If you completely ban it, then people having to Google for sites, or worse, go on the dark web and look for sites, and that's where they come across with people that can, you know, give a crap what happens to them.
And this is, I guess, the conundrum that that a lot of operators are faced with now in general, is that, you know, reputable operators, they want to go into locally regulated markets, and they want to do things right, and they want to be a part of this drive to legitimize the industry and so on and so forth. But sometimes they are faced with regulators who are perhaps over-regulating in that sense that you were saying with now in Italy, advertisement ban, that are only benefiting the operators that are outside of the regulation. Obviously, how does GIG view locally regulated markets in general, and like, what's your strategy going into that?
I suppose in one sense, like, we look at locally regulated markets as a sort of key area for potential partners. Last year, we did partner with quite a few operators that were sort of incumbents or land based within a sort of specific territory and regulation. For us, actually, kind of an important part of our growth in terms of who we sort of profile as a good client type. Again, I think there's much more longevity in a client like that within the kind of regulated market. It's certainly helpful when, and I would, you know, love to get globally all regulators together, but it's certainly helpful when there's a bit more coherence between regulations, you know, like if someone's regulating, if they're following a similar kind of framework to somewhere that has already regulated, it makes it sort of far better for people going into the providers to then sort of set up in a way and kind of better technology, you know, for in one instance that can then be used across multiple markets and improved, instead of having to create so many different instances for something quite similar.
At the same time, you know, I would also make, you know, that makes sense for the industry, I think, and the growth of the industry. If you want to be a little bit selfish here, though, like if you are a company like GIG, you know, in the space that you guys are operating in, it's very difficult to operate in many locally regulated markets for the reason you are saying. Every jurisdiction is different from the other, and being able to be on top of the regulation in so many different markets is obviously very resource heavy for the organizations. But at the same time, you know, if you as GIG, you are a resourceful organization, you have big resources, so you are able to tackle these issues. And that also means that it's quite difficult to compete on your level. Like, you have to have a lot of resources to be able to be on par with GIG, for example. So it's a blessing and a curse, right?
Yeah, you also have to sort of have, you know, good flexible technology that is adaptable to different regulations that we have. And I think, again, is reflected in the number of new regulated markets we've we are entering in this year.
Yeah.
And sort of continue sort of to plan to enter in the years to come. Like, that type of technology also is technology that can then sort of more easily improve and improve itself when it comes, again, sort of going full circle to our early conversations around things like player protection.
Yeah.
You know, like, I think it's got to a point where almost as its entirety, as an industry, you know, we're all upping our game a little bit. And perhaps that does mean we all need to invest a bit more in better technologies. We need to invest a bit more in everything we really do.
Yeah, but exactly.
I was thinking about this, I can't remember, I saw a comment a while ago, but people trying to sort of push out, you know, a price point as the key kind of sales piece, and saying, like, you know, oh, we're able to offer cheaper prices or discount or something along those lines. I just, for me, that's the wrong way that you should position your product within an industry like gambling, you know, where I said we, because of the type of industry, because of the dark side of it, is a very dark place to be, whether it's on the kind of, you know, addict side, etc. That it shouldn't be about price point. It needs to be on quality and value. Like, you need to be putting forward the very best you possibly can. And actually, if the position to you is someone saying, well, this is a lot cheaper, or, you know, they're pushing price, then you have to ask yourself, where's that money being cut from? You know, it's
like, exactly. But it's,
you know, it's a buy like a,
yeah, it's a business model question too. I mean, it's something I find really interesting is, like, compare Evolution with NetEnt, let's say pre-acquisition times, right? So back in the day, in the early 2010s or the late 2000s, NetEnt was a lot bigger than Evolution, right? And if you compare their business models, it's like, on the one hand, you have NetEnt, who are producing the traditional games, and which are just animations, lower cost to produce them, lower cost to run them, and so on and so forth. Versus Evolution, who have to hire thousands of dealers, build studios. It's extremely, you know, make sure that this, the fraud detection. I mean, all these things. And then you ask yourself, you know, how is it that with this heavy business model that Evolution have, that they still managed to grow so much that they ended up acquiring NetEnt, when NetEnt has such a strong position in the market? And I think the reason for that is that it was quite easy to compete with NetEnt. All you needed to do was to have a couple of talented game producers, people who are talented at building the games, and that's it, you know, there's some creativity. Yeah. Whereas Evolution, you know, to compete with Evolution, you have to build this, like, crazy organization around it, right? Yeah. So it's a blessing and a curse in their business model, right? That on the one hand, it's very, very heavy to lift that operation. But on the other hand, it means that it's very difficult to compete with Evolution at the same time. And perhaps with the locally regulated markets, it presents an opportunity as well for GIG and the same area that, you know, it is very difficult to compete on your terms, because to build an organization that can compete with GIG, you have to obviously build up this competence in a wide range of markets. And for you guys, the more markets that you are able to offer, the bigger you can be. Is that a fair comparison, you think? Or I'm building up scenarios here, but
yeah, I think to an extent, sure.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, like you say, you know, our approach is to be kind of regulated in the markets that make sense, but we're also not sort of blindly chasing every market out there. You know, it has to make business sense for us as well, whether that be kind of, you know, partner-led, that we've got someone that already is on the platform wanting to go into a new market, or there is opportunity within a market that's regulating that we want to pursue and kind of partner with. So
yeah,
there's a lot more behind it, as I said, than just kind of Googling who's regulating and then going after it.
Yeah, well, that's fair enough.
A lot of work goes into regulation, you know, regardless of your size or your sort of flexibility. Like, there is still work that goes into it. But, you know, we're lucky, a gig that we have a lot of, like, really, really talented people across the business that you know, work incredibly hard to get us to the point that we need to be for our partners.
Yeah, and looking at two really hot locally regulated markets at the moment, which is Germany and the Netherlands, who are about to become regulated now. You know, something I noticed now when the quarterly reports from a lot of the listed iGaming operators came out earlier in January and February is that the market reacted really heavily based on the risk profile in those two markets in Germany. So, for example, Betsson, I think it was Betsson, who had a quite substantial part of their revenue coming from Germany. When that was disclosed in the quarterly report, the share price of Betsson fell on those news. And so I'd like to ask you a little bit. The market seems to be very scared of Germany as a locally regulated market. The assumption is that once the regulation is in place, that a lot of revenue will be lost, basically. What's your analysis of the Germany and Netherlands specifically? Do you think that it's justified, or is the market just being a bit spooked?
Probably a little of both. you know, I think it's probably kind of more short term in terms of it kind of correcting itself. But I think, like, we see a lot of opportunity in both those markets as they regulate. Mm. You know, we have partners looking at both. We have sort of partners coming onto the platform that are specifically kind of going into them. So from our point of view, we do see there being kind of huge value in both as they sort of become regulated, as they were prior to, I guess, regulation as well. Like, you know, again, it's a necessity, right?
Yeah.
It's a necessity, I think, across the whole piece. When you look at kind of the global gaming landscape, that regulation is needed for the long-term sort of stability of the industry.
Yeah, and that goes back a little bit, I guess, to the question where we open up to here. You know, the legitimacy of the industry and what that can bring for the future. You know, when we talked here the other week, James, I mean, we identified a couple of different factors to legitimize the industry truly, and I think player protection, one of them, absolutely. You know, regulation, one of them, absolutely. But another thing that I find interesting to talk about is, again, going back to purpose. You know, what is the purpose of this industry? And I think within the iGaming industry, a lot of employees are asking themselves this. You know, it's a stigmatized industry still in a lot of ways, and a lot of family and friends of employees in this industry are having to justify why they work in a tainted industry and so on and so forth. You know, so if we solve player protection, if there is more locally regulated markets and so forth, can the iGaming still find itself a purpose?
Yeah, I think it will. I mean, I think it does already. Like we touched on, as you said, when we spoke earlier, that, you know, a huge part of it is entertainment, right? And I think we're taking huge steps in that direction, where perhaps if some people that work within the industry worry slightly about the stigma of it, that they can, I guess, sort of be more proud of sharing certain elements of their day-to-day or parts of the industry. But I think kind of the more steps taken towards kind of enhancing the entertainment part, you know, the better it will be viewed. But I think we're really getting there. Like, I think, you know, there's been huge leaps forwards in what providers are sort of offering now, that goes far beyond sort of just watching a wheel spin to try and hit yourself, kind of get a win, right?
Yeah. You know, because you ask yourself the question, I mean, there's, from ESG perspective and just the perspective in general, like what mantle should the industry try to take? You know, I mean, some organizations, they try to do good by donating and doing charity work and so on and so forth. And the interesting thing is that a lot of charities are not accepting donations from the iGaming industry because it comes from gambling, who is seen sometimes as not something positive for society. Then it raises a little bit the question again, like, can the iGaming industry, is the end goal of the industry to be seen as neutral? Because take the video game industry, for example. I wouldn't say that the video game industry is seen as something positive for the world or positive for society, but it's also not seen as something negative. And perhaps the video gaming industry has found its place there. They don't really have a chip on their shoulder to prove themselves. They are what they are, kind of thing.
There's still shit in view of video game industry, right? Like, even just 10 years ago, it was very much kind of single console in your own home, either playing by yourself or with a couple of friends sat around.
Yeah.
Now it's very much entering the mainstream, partly driven by, innovation and better internet globally. But it's moving into the sports space. It's very much, I think, kind of the norm, I guess, almost, that as you put things in the black and white category of being positive or negative, I don't think it's any more neutral. I think it's more positive because of it being so mainstream now.
Yeah, perhaps it is like edging towards something a bit positive in that sense that it's like, yes, especially in COVID times, it's video gaming is connecting people in the end of the day. And maybe that is the natural, connection that you should make for the video gaming industry. It's like, if you want to make an argument that is positive for society, is that, yeah, it's connecting people around the world. It's an easy argument to make. But
also entertaining. Yeah,
and entertaining.
People enjoy watching.
Yeah, but I don't think that I think there's a lot of work for the iGaming industry to do to get to that point, legitimately, so to say. But if we compare it to like the, I don't like generally to compare it to the alcohol industry, because I think that is two separate things. Alcohol is something that's bad for your body, like no matter how little or much you consume it. But still, I think that something that, let's say Heineken, if you're a Heineken, they have been able to build a brand that is not seen as something bad for society. Why do you think that is, that Heineken have managed to do that, and let's say the iGaming industry still have some work to do?
Yeah, I mean, part of it, when you look at Heineken, it's sort of a lot of association, right? Mm. From early days, they sort of hooked themselves in with sports like football, which is incredibly mainstream, and pivoted a lot of, I guess, the ad around the entertainment side of having a drink. And very much like, and this is where, a lot of, if you compare it to alcohol, a lot of them do well, which is the normalization of it, putting it into a normal situation. And that's what's like a little bit harder, for example, with gambling companies is, you can have maybe an advert of a family dinner and someone just sit there spinning on a slot on their phone or something, right? Whereas perhaps, someone might easily have a glass of wine over a family meal in an advert. And again, it sort of normalizes the situation, and there's that kind of slight difference. But that's just how Heineken and others have been able to position it. And I think, where we can add more, or pivot more around the entertainment piece of the industry, is where we can start associating it with more normalized situations. And that's where, for example, like, you see someone like Paddy Power do kind of so well to an extent in, I think, breaking down that barrier a little bit between, the obvious of what it is, which is gambling, betting, and the entertainment piece, and kind of bringing it into the everyday. Now, I don't think there's anyone that hasn't seen some kind of viral video or image that they've created and laughed at it, whether you gamble or not. So I think they've done a really good job at doing that, sort of, as I said, through kind of that social side.
And I agree with you as well. I think that's
being lighthearted about it as well. There's a step to sort of put forward about not being kind of too serious so much of the time. And again, I think that side of it, people like Paddy and others have done quite well.
Exactly. And, you know, I think, you know, going back to Heineken, I think what they have been able to do is to kind of connect two dots with each other. It's like alcohol on its own and like sitting alone drinking Heineken on a Friday night is like, that's society see that as bad. Okay.
I mean, yeah.
Whereas when you're at the football game, hanging out with your friends and like you're enjoying the game and having a beer, that's like 1 + 1 = 2. It's like, this is fun. This is something that brings value to people.
Exactly. I think like they understood their place, right? As you say, an advert with someone sat by themselves in a dark room and a can of Heineken is probably not going to put forward, you know, something that might entice others to do the same. But having a bunch of friends together cheering on their favorite team in the Champions League or whatever it is, while having a drink, as I said earlier, it sort of normalizes the whole situation. And I think it's, you know, reflective to an extent with online gambling or gambling in general. Is like, you know, the person sat by themselves in a dark room spinning a wheel is not exactly the best sort of portrayal of it, but actually a bunch of friends together that are you know, either placing bets on sports or on the races, or even sat there kind of with a group pot on online playing slots, like that's quite entertaining. You know, and that's where that's where sort of I think kind of we need to position ourselves more. And again, it's showing that that is what it is, right? It's an entertaining and it's the fun side of it, and what we're wanting to get away from and, you know, put an end to is the negative and harmful side.
Exactly.
Which can be done. Like measures are in place that have, you know, hugely taken away the harmful side over the years, and there's still work to be done. But like, I think so long as we're all kind of jointly striving for the same thing, you know, it goes back to the point you made with Kindred's announcement. If actually everyone turned around, every operator turned around did the same, and even on supplier side and every part of the industry, we all sort of made some kind of commitment, then perhaps it would sort of take a lot of heat off us and give a kind of really nice sort of view from the outsiders and, you know, calm regulators down so they don't put such extreme policies in that, in turn, like I say, with the advertising, could actually end up being more harmful than good.
Yeah. And you know, something I find so interesting as well, I agree with everything you say, James, and something I find so interesting is just comparing the alcohol industry with the tobacco industry. So you have two industries that are, you can make the argument that they are equally harmful for your body. You know, you're a smoker, that is not going to be good for you in the long run. You're a drinker, this is not going to be good for you in the long run. We know these two facts, right? But the alcohol industry has been able to find its purpose. And, you know, from an outside point of view, the tobacco industry hasn't been able to find its purpose, it feels like. And look at regulation and comparing the two, you know. You see more and more.
Tobacco had found a purpose years back. And then when sort of more research went into it, it started kind of losing it again.
Yeah.
There's a period where everything was related to it, right? Every race car you see drive around would be kind of Marlboro advertised, and people smoked on planes, on trains, on everything. It was very normal. You probably had doctors sort of having a cigarette during surgery, but through kind of understanding, research, etc., like, you know, it's become sort of a more extreme negative, I guess.
Yeah, because like, I mean, the marketing strategy for the tobacco industry was the, you know, the Camel's classic advertisement, more doctors smoke Camels, you know, therefore Camel is good for you.
Yeah.
And it seems like they took that approach that they were kind of denying science in that respect until they couldn't anymore. Whereas the alcohol industry more found its like real purpose, you know, it's not like, I don't feel that the alcohol industry is, it's like
I think there's slight extremes in the sense, though, that like, you know, a sustainable amount of alcohol or alcohol within guidelines, you know, as much as you're right in the sense that, you know, even a drop, I guess, has some kind of negative impact on the body. it's nothing, I think, kind of compared to the single cigarette impact on the body, and also kind of the longer term effect on sort of repair. But
yeah,
not too dark, so Ben, I'll get too much into that.
Yeah. No, but I would still make the argument. I mean, I would still make the argument that the reason why the alcohol industry is seen as more legitimate and it's more accepted in society than smoking, which it seems to be like really going down in general at in these modern times, is just the fact that they have found this this purpose in general, being connected to happy emotions and getting together and so on and so forth. So the question I'm raising, like the reason I'm making this argument, is if we now look at the agave industry and we break it down into products. So we have, let's take three products. We take poker, we take sports betting, and we take casino. So purpose of poker, you know, you can easily make the argument that it's a social thing. It brings people together. We have a great night together. You know, you don't play against the house, you play against each other. So you can connect those two dots, right? It has a purpose.
Yeah.
Same with sports betting as well. I mean, you can make the exact same argument to sports betting as you can make with alcohol. It's like you go to the game, you and your friends, you bet on one of the teams, and it brings excitement. And that has a purpose too. But then I'm interested as well, just to something I haven't figured out for myself is kind of the purpose with casino games, for example.
Do you not see it more on the entertainment side? Like, I mean, I think we sort of touched on earlier the kind of evolution of casino games and slots. And I think there's one sort of social piece that you now see, whether it's in a similar way to perhaps kind of get together to play poker, people get together and perhaps kind of pool money to spin on slots. Like, you know, being to events where that happens, and it's quite an exciting piece to sort of sit around and watch kind of the wheel turn and hopefully sort of your pot go up slightly. Yeah. I think there's also new moves in a sense of people watching others play, right? Like we're seeing a lot more
exactly
of that.
Twitch.
Yeah, Twitch style sort of someone either playing online, and even there's been streaming services to people with in a casino on the machines. And then I think there's the personal entertainment piece. You see games from, who is it, like Nick Robinson in Big Time Gaming, where he's putting them out with, I remember one he showed me a few years ago, which was like gold. And every time you're sort of progressing in that, the song would, you get further into the song, right? But that's kind of emotional drive on a certain, I guess, group of people that enjoyed that song. But that's where there's a huge amount of entertainment, right? It's like there are games constantly created about your favorite films, your TV shows, you know, your favorite board games, songs, as was the case in that. I think that is actually something that is arguably quite entertaining for the person that, you know, for the person playing it.
Yeah,
sort of that variety of, like, there was a debate, I think, with a few on a sort of webinar podcast you guys had a week or so ago, arguing about kind of percentile difference or recent kind of movements on RTP, etc.
Yeah,
and I think like it was even I think Magnus maybe that had actually come from the content provider side. He was the one saying, yeah, you know, okay, there's you know, variation that some people will look at, some people will genuinely care about, like RTP when playing, but actually sort of there's the wider piece that are looking for entertainment out of the slot, you know? And I think that's the bit that, again, we need to sort of grab hold of and run with.
Absolutely.
Because again, that's the understanding that it's not something, it's not an investment opportunity necessarily for you to come and start playing slots, you know, specifically looking for return. You need to be coming, your intention to come on and play is in shape of this sort of additional value of entertainment, right?
Yeah.
And like you're sort of saying with sports, with poker, you know, it adds a level of entertainment to the game that you're watching or playing.
Yeah, and it's such a good point you're making, James, with like with the Twitch streamers, you know, the fact that others enjoy watching people play casino because they want to see the highs and they want to see the lows and they want to see emotions, right? That is the whole point of it.
Yeah. You know, yeah. that's you know, and how many steps away from that is someone going onto Netflix and, you know, watching a program about real estate agents. All you're doing is watching someone else go about their day-to-day activity and job, right? And for that, you're paying a monthly subscription. I mean, when you really break it down, you think, like, what are you doing? But, yeah. you know, it's entertaining. That is an entertaining thing to do. As I said, you're going through someone else's highs, lows, kind of interaction with whatever they're doing. In that case, like friends or whatever. And that's the same here. Like in the Twitch scenario, as you mentioned, kind of, I see it as no big step between that and any kind of reality shows to an extent. Like you're looking at it and watching it for the same reasons. Like why are people watching like Rev like Gogglebox in the UK, which is basically you're watching someone watching TV.
Yeah.
Which is just crazy to think about, right? But it's hugely entertaining. As much as it is, you know, especially if you kind of enjoy slots, is watching someone else go through the highs and lows of their of their winning and losing, and perhaps, you know, it might entice you also to throw a few quid at a spin, but like that's where it becomes real entertainment, right?
Exactly. And you know, in the end of the day, I think the goal for the industry, as if you look at casino, should be that you as a customer should be able to play, have a slot session, and if you lose by the end of it, you manage to lose a little bit, you should still feel that it's worth it.
Yeah, but also, yeah, exactly. And hopefully with, you know, good operators that are supported by good platforms, you would have been through all the checks prior to you going and watching and in turn playing that knows that you've got, you know, the right level of affordability. You know, you're not spending beyond your means. There's no behavior that shows you're playing erratically or moving into a sort of problem gambler space. That's all technology available now. If we set up that piece, the rest will flow. The rest will flow as it staying as entertainment. You know, absolutely. So I think knowing that we've only got 2 minutes.
Yeah.
Based on a lot of what we discussed, which is obviously about kind of regulation, player safety, like I'll get back to a point that I've mentioned a few times that for me it's more and more about the industry just becoming as transparent as sort of possible. I guess, you know, no business is 100% sort of transparent or can't be with absolutely everything. But the more we can all be transparent and open about every part of our business, whether it's like we are, you know, who we're partnering with, because I mean, twofold, A, we're really proud of who we partner with, but B, we want to be transparent about that. You know, these are the markets that we're operating or we're sort of supporting in and the type of person we are supporting. That in turn adds a level of accountability onto us, onto them, like they made the choice to go with us. And through that, I think everyone will in turn sort of start up in their game, you know, and that's where that's the change or what's needed more of.
The future of the agri industry is bright, my friend. And we're both part of it. We're both in it.
Like I think it is. Yeah. I think it's getting to a really good stage. And as we said, so we're on the cusp of, you know, breaking down what has been sort of some barriers to the outside world or the world beyond the walls of kind of gambling.
Yeah, I can't wait to see how this develops. I can't wait to see how things develop with Kindred and their commitments and if others are going to continue. If it all kind of heads that direction.
Good on them. Like, they've done a really great thing, I think, in sort of coming out and saying that.
Yeah. James, we decided to schedule this podcast half an hour earlier so that we would have time to speak about everything that we wanted to speak about, but we still only got about 2 points out of 10 or something like that we had planned today.
Maybe we can do part two in the coming weeks.
Absolutely. I think we should plan that. I think we should plan that for sure. Yeah, we'll plan a bit longer, even still next time. We both have a hard stop now. The clock is 3 p.m. when we are recording this. James, always a pleasure, buddy. Anytime you want to come on, let's do it again. Let's do a part two. So many interesting to think about and speak about, and this is what the industry needs, I think. So thank you for coming on today.
Really fun. Thank you very much, mate.
Like always. Take care, buddy.
Bye.